Uncommon Commons is a horror anthology podcast written by George Plank and Alex Vitale. Content warnings can be found in the episode description. Today's story is Auld Lang Syne, written by Alex Vitale.
Do you smell something, John?
Oh, nice try, Jane. I'm not falling for that one again. Come on, where are you hiding the chloroform this time?
Why, whatever could you mean?
You know exactly what I mean. Last week you took two of my kidneys.
Sure, but I gave you three the week before that.
I don't think that's the right amount.
Oh? I'm sorry, did you graduate from medical school?
No, I didn't graduate, but I still attended for 3 years.
Then who are you to tell me how many spleens...
Kidneys
a person should have? And I'll thank you not to get off topic. Now, can you, or can you not, smell that?
What?
That!
What does it smell like?
Kind of... earthy?
Again, what does that smell like?
Oh, don't expect me to hold your hand every step of the way. Use your imagination once in a while.
I don't think I can smell anything.
Yeah, I can fix that. Probably. Maybe. One way to find out.
Hey, look! Mail!
Mail?
Yeah, mail! You want it? Go get it!
They say that the holidays are the hardest time of year for some people. I guess that I'm one of those. When I was a kid, the holidays were fun. My elementary school would have a big generic holiday celebration and then send us off on winter vacation. I'd spend time with my family, and we would all gather together for dinner on Christmas Eve. The house was always full and loud in the best kind of way, with drink and good cheer flowing steadily together. Christmas Day was chill, and in a secular household, it meant that there was all the fun of presents and none of the responsibility of church. Then things would quiet down until New Year's, and my sister and I would play with our new toys, carefree and unaware of the troubles of the world. My parents always focused more on New Year's, I guess as an attempt to separate us from the religious holidays. We were never told about Santa, and our parents would always save the biggest or most exciting present to give us on New Year's Eve. It never bothered me or Logan. In fact, I liked it better that way. It made me feel unique, like my family had a special tradition that no one else did. Every year, my parents would throw a massive New Year's party at our house. My mom always insisted on having a theme, and my dad would go all out with the decorations. Family and friends were expected to come in costume, and even us kids got in on the fun. One year, Mom declared that the party's theme would be 20s, and she spent hours helping me and Logan get ready. We each got sparkly flapper dresses, and Logan's boyish haircut lent nicely to the whole vibe, even if it was weird to see her out of overalls. The party lasted all night, with games and dancing and drinking, though us kids got sparkling apple cider instead of champagne. The clock would count down to midnight, the ball would drop, and our parents would give us our presents. The whole thing was a rush, and Logan and I would ride that high right up until the restart of school. These were some of the best memories I had growing up, and some of the most painful to remember after the fire. I don't really know how it started. One of the firefighters told me that it had been an electrical fire, but by the time they put it out, there was too much damage to even say for certain where it had come from. I was 18 and away at my first semester of college, just packing up to come home for winter break. I remember when I got the call from my grandmother. I remember the drive back down to the house, too. Those were the longest 3 hours of my life. By the time I got home, there wasn't much left but ash. No one got out. Not Mom, not Dad, not Logan, not even our goddamn dog. I still can't stand the smell of burning toast. It's been a decade now. I'm a ripe old 28, and I have jack all to show for it besides a degree in comp sci and a crummy little apartment in South Boston. It took me nearly 6 years to complete college, and it took me 2 extra to get on my feet once I graduated. I lived with my grandmother for a while, but a stroke on a sunny Sunday afternoon made short work of that. I do all right for myself, I suppose, all things considered. I have a job that I hate and a popcorn ceiling roof over my head and a small collection of succulents under my bedroom window. My therapist said that it'd be good for me to have something that depended on me to keep living. I'm not sure how true that is, because I don't feel a particularly strong bond to cacti, but I'm doing it all the same. It's at least a routine, and that does help. It's New Year's Eve today. This year it fell on a Saturday, and from what I can tell of the bustling city streets, everyone is in good spirits because of it. My jaunt to the closest ABC store turned into a 40-minute expedition, as apparently every Bostonian in the vicinity had the same idea. I trek back to my apartment with a bottle of Prosecco, I'm too cheap to buy champagne, tucked safely under my arm. The wind whips something wicked, and my hat is pulled down so far over my head that I can barely see. But I arrive back at my apartment relatively unscathed, although more than a little wind-chafed. On my way up to my third-floor apartment, I pass Mr. Sanger on his way out of his own. My landlord is a gruff man and doesn't particularly care for pleasantries, but I greet him all the same. He responds with a verbose grunt that only mildly resembles the word hello, and pushes past me. I take 2 steps up the stairs and turn back, pretending like the question about to come out of my mouth only just dawned on me, like I hadn't been pestering him about it since late November. "Oh, hey, were you able to get someone to look at my stove?" I ask. My voice is higher pitched than it normally is, and I feel like a serf asking her lord for mercy. "In the new year," comes a terse reply. He swings open the front door and takes a step out. I can just barely catch his final statement. "Just don't fiddle with it and it'll be fine." I have half a mind to inform him that I would like to be able to actually, you know, cook, but he's gone before the words form. It's not like I have the energy to fight him on it anyway. I clump up the stairs and slip into my dark apartment, keen to isolate myself for the night. It's about 7 o'clock in the evening, and outside my window the snow has begun to fall. It makes no difference to me. It isn't like I'm planning on going out on the town tonight. As cramped and stale as my apartment may be, it is far more inviting to me than any parties would be. I kick off my snow boots and shed my coat next to the radiator, making my way over to the kitchenette. The Prosecco bottle goes straight into the freezer to chill, and I bend over to inspect the stove. To hell with Mr. Sanger. I'm out of frozen meals, and I need to be able to cook. Old gas stoves like this are beyond me, though. I try to switch on the front burner, but to no avail. It lets out a great hiss and sputters a few sad sparks, but it doesn't catch. I once tried Googling how to relight the pilot light on the damn thing, but this unit is so cheap and old that no tutorials online were helpful. With a grunt, I switch the burner back off. It continues to emit a steady puff of air, but at least it's no longer sparking. Giving the stove a kick for good measure, I flee to the living room. My TV is small, an old box set that I inherited from my grandmother after she passed. I can't really get streaming services on it, or at least I have no idea how to, so instead I had settled for a DVR and the occasional hunt through thrift stores for a worthwhile DVD. Tonight I'm in no mood to be festive, so I settle on a set of old 90s sitcom episodes. I pop it into the DVR, slap that a few times just to make sure it's working, and wander back into the kitchen as the menu screen crackles to life. A double check of my fridge and freezer confirmed that I don't have any real food, but it isn't like I plan to have a good meal anyway. Tonight's dinner is going to be strictly of the liquid variety. I grope around the cabinets for a clean wine glass, rinse it feebly in the sputtering sink, and clink 2 ice cubes into it. I'm far too impatient to wait for the Prosecco to cool any longer. I pour myself a larger helping than I probably should, and then stand debating whether I should put the bottle back in the fridge. It's a losing battle, and I take it and my glass with me to the sofa. It's going to be a long night. I might as well make myself comfortable. 3 episodes and 2 glasses in, I start to feel the effects of my drink. The screen of the television, fuzzy and blurry in its own right, is going in and out of focus, and that telltale heaviness in the pit of my stomach is starting to settle in. I'm not quite nauseous, but I'm certainly not sober as I sink back into the depths of my lumpy couch and let my eyes slip shut. The darkness behind my eyelids is a welcome sight, and the laugh track from the television is distant and fading fast. I'm out before the end of the fourth episode. Sleep is blissfully dreamless, which seems to only happen when I've imbibed too much. There's none of the usual images of fire or the sound of agonized screams, just peaceful, simple darkness. It flits by in seconds, and it feels as though I've only been asleep for a matter of minutes when I'm shaken awake. That's the first odd thing, shaken. The hand on my shoulder is light, but steadily rocks me into the waking world. I blink my eyes open to see the ceiling. The ceiling and an out-of-focus face. It's perfectly pale and ovular, with cherry-red lips and deep, set-back, black eyes. Something crosshatches the face, and it takes a moment before my eyes focus more, and I see that it's sheet music, painted onto the pale expanse of the face above me. It takes another 2 seconds before I realize that this isn't a face at all, it's a mask. Panic shoots through my system, and I sit up in a flash, scrambling backward, away from the bizarre assailant. I must startle them in my own panic, because they hold up their hands and take a step back. "Whoa, whoa, Robin, chill," says a voice, a girl's voice, a familiar one. "It's just me." I pause, taking a moment to rub my eyes. When I open them again, the person in the mask is still there, standing and waiting for an answer. The voice tugs a memory that I thought I'd lost, and hesitantly I ask, "Logan?" "Yeah," she breathes, barely audible behind her mask. "Sorry, I didn't mean to scare you. Mom said to come wake you." What? I ask. It's now that I fully come to my senses, absorbing the world around me for the first time since waking up. Gone is a crappy living room of my studio apartment. It's been replaced by a teenager's bedroom, complete with dated posters of boy bands and Polaroids of mall outings. I'm not on a couch, but a twin bed, my twin bed, for my childhood bedroom. Casting a furtive glance around, I take in the sight. My luggage, the one that I used to pack for college, was sitting in the corner by my dresser. My fish tank, complete with my old goldfish, sits proudly atop it. My breath quickens again, and my heartbeat races. "What's going on? Are you feeling okay?" Logan asks, sitting down at the edge of my bed. "You look like you're about to be sick." I open my mouth to reply, but no words come out. I swallow thickly and look back at her. The mask covers her entire face, and I can't make out any features below it. Still, her voice holds levity, and I can imagine her smiling beneath it. I take another shaky breath and give her a quick nod. "Okay?" She hesitates, but after a moment's deliberation, she stands up and heads for the door. "Come downstairs when you're ready. Mom and Dad are getting stuff ready for the party. I left your costume on the desk." I watch Logan leave. The blood continues to pound in my ears, and for a moment I feel frozen. I will myself to think rationally for a moment. It's just a dream. That's all it is. A dream created from alcohol and trauma and nothing more. I feel fused to my bed, immobilized as I sit and stare around my room. Maybe, I think, hopefully, this could be a good dream. It didn't seem too bad, just a little weird. Logan wasn't melting before my eyes, and nothing was catching fire, so that had to be a decent sign. I can indulge a little. I'll wake up soon enough. Once I feel less like I'll crumble to the floor if I stand up, I slide off my bed and slink over to my desk. Nothing changes as I move, and the floor doesn't fall out from beneath me, so I start to think that this might be one of those lucid dreams, I think they call them. The costume is just where Logan had said she left it, smack in the middle of my cluttered desk. There's no mask included, but the fancy dress is similar to the one she was wearing. As I get changed, I think about what she said. Mom and Dad are getting ready for the party. In something of a daze, I float through the motions of getting dressed and go downstairs to find what was waiting for me. The house looks the same as I remember it, vivid and perfect as I'd last seen it. The second-to-last step of the stairs squeaks in its old, high-pitched whine as I put my weight on it, and I'm reminded of all those childhood late nights skipping it, trying to sneak cookies from the kitchen. The living room is already decorated as I walk through into the kitchen. Dad must have gone all out, because everything is covered in tinsel and there's a disco ball hanging from the chandelier. I hear voices coming from the kitchen, something that sounds almost like arguing. With only a moment's hesitation, I walk in. "Ed, I'm serious," cries my mother, slapping away Dad's hand from the meticulously arranged crudité board. "Leave it for the guests." Dad's laugh rings in my ears, and for a brief moment, I feel like I could cry. I'd forgotten what it sounded like, too afraid to watch old home videos. I hover in the doorway of the kitchen, watching as he snatches a vegetable off the plate and swoops out of my mom's reach. "It's celery, Jeannie. Nobody's gonna miss celery." He takes a decisive bite of it under his mask, but he moves too fast for me to catch a glimpse of his face. It's only then that he notices me. "Hey, look who's up." He turns to face me, and I see his mask properly. It's one of those spooky Bauta masks, the kind you see in Venice. He strides over to me and gives me a tight hug, and I feel the tears swell up for real this time, though I try to fight them back. It won't be the first time that I wake up with a tear-streaked face. He pulls back in alarm when he hears me sniffle. I can't see his eyes behind the mask, just like with Logan, but his voice holds concern all the same. "Whoa, geez, what's the matter, Rob?" When I shake my head dismissively, he asks Mom over his shoulder, "Hey, where's her mask?" Mom comes over to check on me as Dad pulls away. Her mask looks like Logan's, but in pink detailing instead. "She'll get it later. Robbie, honey, are you okay? Come here, eat something. You'll feel better." I take a moment to compose myself, wiping away tears awkwardly on my sleeve. "I'm fine. Sorry. It's been a while since I've seen you." Mom and Dad exchange a glance, though how they can see each other through the masks I don't know. Dad claps me on the back, saying, "Well, yeah, it's been a long semester." "I knew sending her to an out-of-state school was a bad idea," mumbles Mom, going back to her food prep. She keeps mumbling to herself as she works. "A nice in-state close to home would have been much better." Dad looks at me again, and I can swear I see the hint of a smile, even through the mask. He swipes something off the counter while Mom has her back turned and shoves a chocolate-covered pretzel into his mouth. "Go help your sister. She's putting balloons up in the sunroom." Feeling dazed, I nod and slip out of the room, but not before I see Dad hug Mom from behind. I used to think it was gross when they showed PDA, and as a kid I would always blow raspberries whenever they did. Now it brings a smile to my face. There seem to be so many tiny, seemingly insignificant memories coming back to me in this dream, things that I long since blocked out to keep from dwelling on the past. As I move through the house, Winston runs between my legs, and his tail clips my shin, but he moves too fast for me to pet him. By the time I get to the sunroom, Logan has pretty much finished with her portion of the decoration. Red, black, and white balloons pour over the love seat and cling to the window blinds, and she's struggling to balance on one of the sofa arms to tape streamers to the ceiling. She must hear me, because she shouts as I come in, "Robin, spot me!" Time seems to go by in a whirlwind as the day sheds the hours. Our street goes dark as the hours tick by, and pretty soon our front walkway is lit by street lamps. Cars pull up and park, and neighbors cross their lawns while Logan and I sip sparkling cider and watch out the windows. The house smells delicious with Mom's cooking, and there are even a few blissful moments where I forget that this is just a dream. People come in with their masks already on, and it's difficult for me to tell who everyone is. There are voices that stroke some distant memory in my brain, but I can't quite latch on to who they belong to. Still, people file through the front door, hugging me and Logan in turn and making vague comments about how much we've grown up. My breath catches in my throat a few times, a tiny, nagging voice in the back of my head reminding me that Logan didn't grow up. But I tamp it down. No need to remember that while everyone is having so much fun. A man in a Scaramouche mask bends down and presses the tip of his mask's nose against my cheek in the pantomime of a kiss, and I'm suddenly engulfed in the scent of my grandfather's aftershave. Another masked man, tips the nozzle of a poorly wrapped champagne bottle towards me and mumbles a promise to squirrel away a glass for me, and the image of my Uncle Norman letting me sip from his wine glass at Christmas pops into my head. The night continues on like this for hours, passing by in a blur of colors and masks and hints of memories. I even hear my grandmother's voice, loudly recalling her life in Europe before the war. And every time I try to catch a glimpse of the faces underneath, the masks are quickly adjusted back into place. I seem to be the only one sans mask, and my mother doesn't bring it up. The drinks keep pouring, and the party goes raging on as I mingle, staying close to Logan or Dad or Mom in turn. The party goes to my head in no time at all. If this is a dream, it's the best damn dream I've had in years. As the clock ticks closer to 12, I feel Logan grab my arm and yank me towards the living room. She squeals in my ear. It's time! I'm dragged away from the kitchen, where I was trying unsuccessfully to get food. She deposits me on the living room sofa and plops down next to me. Dad and Mom are already there, seated opposite us, and on the coffee table sits one pretty wrapped box. Its tag bears Logan's name, and she wastes no time in opening it. I try to peek inside, but Mom calls my name. This one's for you, sweetheart. She leans forward, holding out a mask. It's the full face painted style, just the same as she and Logan are wearing. The detailing is black, but it has little chrysanthemums painted in cascades along the cheeks. I take it, staring down at it as it stares up at me. It's a little late for this, I say lamely, turning it over in my hands. I know. We know, Mom replies gently. She reaches out and takes Dad's hand into hers, holding it in her lap. They stare directly at me, the gaping eye holes of their masks clinging to my every movement. I'm numbly aware of other eyes on me, dozens of them. The other party guests have gathered around and are watching, eagerly. They whisper words, and it takes me a second to realize that they're counting down. 8, 7, 6, 5. We know you've been wanting this for a long time, Dad states, squeezing Mom's hand. 4, 3. I helped convince them, Logan tells me. 2. I grip the mask in my hands and bring it up to my face, tying the ribbons with fumbling fingers. 1. With uproarious shouts, everyone cheers and the clock strikes midnight. Just as quickly, their voices fade into the staticky voices of the DVD menu screen. I blink my eyes open and instinctively reach up to touch my face. But all that's there is flesh, no mask. The digital clock under my television tells me that it's 12 o'clock exactly, but in my drowsy state I can barely make out the numbers, much less care. I feel sicker than I usually do after an alcohol-induced nap, and the longing for my family burns hot in my chest. Something else burns, too, a faint, stinging sensation in my nose. My sleepiness mingles with nausea and lightheadedness. Quietly, just barely audible over the noises from my DVR, is a rhythmic clicking noise coming from the kitchen. It keeps clicking as I settle back into the sofa, ready to fall back asleep. My last thought before I shut my eyes is whether or not I remember to turn off the stove properly. Then, though, sleep has claimed me again, and I hope that this next dream will be as pleasant as the last.
Do you still smell it, Jane?
Yes? Ugh, somehow it's gotten worse. I'm starting to feel sick.
Deep breaths, Jane. Deep breaths.
Whoa, things are getting woozy. Since when are there two of you?
What are you talking about, Jane? There's always been two of us.
No, John, you moron. Look over there.
What? Oh. Hmm. Yep, that's mold.
You didn't have to lick it.
How else was I supposed to know for sure?
Huh. Strange growth pattern. It looks like a body outline.
Maybe someone died there.
Given the apartment, that's not too far of a logical jump.
Hmm. Gross.
Yeah. Hey, you better throw it out or something.
Why me?
I'm already feeling the ill effects. You're untouched at the moment.
Fine. Rolls up really easily. Go on now, get! Don't look at me like that. You know Jane would never let me keep you. Go! You're free now! Go! I'm gonna miss it.
Uncommon Commons is a podcast. It was written and recorded by George Plank and Alex Vitale. Our theme song was composed by Charles Adam Robinson, and our logo was designed by Sam Vitale. Special thanks to our patrons, including Noel San and Mel, who contribute at the $5 level. For $1 a month, you can get access to all of our bonus content, including the Common Area, as well as our actual play miniseries, Need to Escape. More information can be found in the links below. Rate and review us wherever you get podcasts. Stay, and remember, nothing is real.